Welcome to the PAH edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the pulmonary arterial hypertension community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're here at the CHEST 2024 conference in Boston, and our guest today is Dr. Victor Test, Professor of Medicine and Chair of the Pulmonary Vascular Disease Program at Texas Tech School of Medicine in Lubbock. He's been a pulmonologist since 2000 and has worked with pulmonary hypertension patients since 1998. Dr. Test, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for allowing me to speak on this very important and very personal issue.
Tell us a bit about your background and why it's personal and how you got into this.
Well, pulmonary hypertension has been my career in my life since I began training in pulmonary disease. I got interested in it with a chance encounter with a patient as a pulmonary fellow at the at my original fellowship, which was at Scott and White Hospital in Temple, Texas. I went on to do pulmonary vascular training and critical care at the University of California at San Diego, which at that time was one of the preeminent centers in the world for pulmonary hypertension and still is. After that, I went on to become the pulmonary vascular disease center director at Duke University before I moved to Texas Tech in Lubbock. Pulmonary hypertension is not where I started off. I started off to be a urologist. I switched to internal medicine and with the idea of doing pulmonology and critical care because I was interested in critical care. But after meeting and hearing the stories of patients with pulmonary hypertension, I changed the focus of my career so that I could take care of these patients because they embedded themselves in my heart and soul.
What is it about this particular disease that draws you to them?
Well, when I started and I was out at San Diego doing my training, at that time we only had one medication. Patients would read about it in books because at that time, you know, the internet was not as prominent as it is now. And they would be told by physicians and other people that their life expectancy was measured in terms of months or years and that there was no hope. Patients would seek us out in San Diego for a treatment. And at that time, we only had one treatment. It was a continuous IV infusion, which we still use today. But when people would come and we would give them hope, And we'd hear their stories, the struggles that they had faced to come to a diagnosis and receive treatment. I knew then that I wanted to change that for patients wherever I was.
Incredible. And today there are 11 treatments for PH.
Yes, that's right. Our number of treatments keep expanding, and hopefully within the next year or two, we'll have even more options for our patients who so desperately need them.
If I could go back a bit, why do you think this particular disease has seen such an explosion of therapies, whereas some others still don't have even a basic treatment?
Boy, that is a really good question. I wish I knew the answer why pulmonary vascular disease has exploded so much. I do think that once a therapy was approved and then a second therapy was approved, the interest in the disease state, now that there was a chance to change the outcome for patients, increased the interest in the disease state substantially.
I see. So how many patients have PH and specifically PAH in the United States today? How prevalent is it?
In the original NIH trial in 1991, it was thought to be 1 or 2 patients per million. And it's been more recently that we realized that it's far more prevalent than we thought. And it's still, while PAH, particularly idiopathic PAH, is relatively rare, the secondary forms of PAH make it much more common. Diseases such as liver disease, HIV, connective tissue diseases, predominantly scleroderma and lupus, thyroid-associated disease, toxin-associated disease, which is on the rise again after a period where it seemed to decline after the anorexigen epidemic in the early 90s. And so we've seen a real increase in that. And I don't, the percentage of the number of patients we see that we don't know, but patients with pulmonary hypertension are not rare. Patients with PH are relatively rare. Pulmonary hypertension due to lung disease, sleep disordered breathing, left heart disease are relatively common in my practice.
Specifically talking about pulmonary arterial hypertension, since that is the disease that we write about a lot, Is there any difference or in prevalence between the United States and other countries, or is there any ethnic or racial variance?
Well, I think that's difficult to define. You know, the instance in the United States seems to be a little more prevalent than in other parts of the world, but is that a true prevalence or is that a diagnostic bias in the United States where we see it more often? In Europe and the U.S., there doesn't seem to be a strong racial bias, although our studies have been predominantly in Caucasians. And again, is that an intrinsic bias in healthcare or the populations that have been studied? And no one can really answer that.
I see. Interesting. I was at the presentation yesterday, and it seems that the common theme that ran throughout the patient stories is that the medical profession did not take them seriously.
I think that, you know, delay in diagnosis is our biggest hurdle to overcome for pulmonary hypertension patients now that we have therapy. And in the original NIH trial, the average to diagnosis was about 2.5 years. 20 years later in the REVEAL registry, it was over 3 years from the time of onset of symptoms to diagnosis. So we haven't gotten better at diagnosing it. And I think a lot of that is that patients with pulmonary hypertension are usually mislabeled as something else. In younger patients, they are told that they're obese, that they have asthma, that they're deconditioned. Whereas older patients are often almost always labeled as having COPD rather than or ischemic heart disease, and they don't undergo evaluation because people make that assumption. They make and they diagnose them with those other disorders. And it's not that the healthcare providers don't care, it's that they make the diagnosis based on what's the most likely thing. And when treatment doesn't change or the patient doesn't improve, they don't continue to look. And so the other issue for patients with pulmonary hypertension, because shortness of breath with exertion is the most common thing, is patients themselves will delay seeking care because they think that they've gotten out of shape or overweight or they smoke too much or their asthma's acting up, or they don't think it's important because the onset is relatively gradual.
Or it could be very sudden, as we saw in some of these case studies, mm-hmm. that people who were relatively healthy suddenly felt dizzy, or they couldn't climb up mm-hmm. a stairs, or in one case couldn't reach something. One patient worked on an oil rig mm-hmm. and couldn't turn a valve all yeah. of a sudden.
That's right. It can be quite sudden in onset, although for most people, if you really dig, you find that the symptoms have been slowly progressing until the point where the symptoms seemed overwhelming.
Tell us a bit about these patient stories and why you consider them so important.
You know, the patient stories, when you hear them, are heart-wrenching. You know, you hear stories of people who are trying to live life. They have dreams and goals. And particularly my patient that we spoke to yesterday in our program, you know, he has big goals with his life. And he was unable to reach them. And he wouldn't have been able to reach them at all if we hadn't started treating him. And now we've given him hope. You know, patients need hope. And, you know, when a patient with pulmonary hypertension is undiagnosed, they are living without hope and they're in desperation. And when you hear their actual stories, it motivates me, and I hope it motivates others, to say, we can do better. We can hear our patients. We can hear their stories. We can take that and what's important to them, and then find a common pathway to diagnosis and treatment that will benefit all patients, but each patient individually.
But ultimately, a lung transplant is the only absolute total cure for the disease, correct?
With lung transplant, it depends on the form of pulmonary hypertension, because there is a form of pulmonary hypertension, which we heard about yesterday, called chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, which is absolutely curable. And because of that, it's incredibly important that our physicians and people look for the disease, because it is curable. And we wouldn't want to have a curable form of an otherwise progressive and debilitating disease. For other forms of pulmonary hypertension, lung transplant is the only cure for the treatment.
Like PAH.
Like PAH, exactly. However, we need to realize that lung transplant is a cure for one problem, but it's an addition of a whole different set of problems. And so our mission should be to diagnose people sooner so that we can prevent them from getting to lung transplant.
I want to ask you, how does the outlook seem for new therapies for the disease?
As I'm sure you're aware, we recently had, earlier this year, a new therapy approved, which works in a completely different pathway, and that is very exciting for us. We expect, because of ongoing trials, that there may be an additional three or four different therapies in the next year or two, which will help us approach patients more individually based on their own characteristics and their capabilities than we've had before. And I think the future for therapies in PH is looking very bright after a period of being sort of calm and unchanging for about 10 years. And now things are really looking up.
That's good to hear. I want to ask you, currently, what is the life expectancy for a patient diagnosed with PAH today?
It's a good question. It comes up a lot because the patients get on the internet and they look this up. And what they usually come back is, well, do I really only have 2.5 to 3 years to live? And the answer is no for most patients. It's really hard to tell someone based on a population how they're going to do. And what most of the data we know about survival from the time of diagnosis relates to patients who were not treated. And we know we can say with some prediction, you know, patients who present with these symptoms or have a worse outcome than patients who don't. But we really don't know, because once the patient receives aggressive and appropriate therapy, their mortality may change significantly. But on average, you know, their outcome, a patient who presents with moderately advanced symptoms, based on studies from 5 or 6 years ago, their survival is better than it was, but it still wouldn't be normal. But our goal is to normalize survival and quality of life. It's not just about living longer, it's about living better. And that should be our goal.
We're just about out of time. Any final thoughts?
Well, I would just encourage our readers, both patients and physicians and healthcare providers, to actively listen to their patients. Let them tell you their stories and their concerns, and realize that while common disease do occur commonly, we need to keep our mind open for the rare disease that we have interventions for.
Thank you. On that note, I'd like to thank you for speaking with us today. We've been talking with Dr. Victor Test, professor of medicine and chair of the pulmonary vascular disease program at Texas Tech School of Medicine in Lubbock. This is Larry Luxner. Thank you for listening.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.